Well, I'm very, very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Philip Kennedy this afternoon. Philip has got interest in contemporary theology, modern theology, liberation theology, and Schiller Beeks, I think he's written on. And most recently, he's written an introduction to modern theology with Torres Press. And just today, his Christianity has been.
I put it away.
Oh, you put it away. I was going to wave it around.
You should have passed it around.
Yes, yeah, so Christianity, History of Christianity, published by Torres Press, which looks really interesting. And I'd encourage you all to get one. Now, today he's speaking in our series, God Across Cultures. And the title of his talk is Naming the Divine, a History of the Concept of God. So, Philip, what to you?
Thank you very much. And I want to say at the outset, I'm very grateful to Professor Flood for inviting me to talk in your midst this afternoon. You have the misfortune of being the first group of people on whom I'm going to try out my ideas. No one has heard me talk about these things before, and I warn you, they're very provisionary ideas because I'm planning a book called God's Career, The Evolution of a Deity. So I'm teasing around ideas, and I'm looking at how the concept of God emerged historically in the West, in Western traditions, Western Semitic traditions, and then Roman and Greek traditions, and European traditions. But I have a great ambition today is that in subsequent conversations with you, whatever I say about this concept of God, I would love to know whether there are resonances in the Hindu tradition, of which I'm an ignoramus. So I'll be very grateful for your reactions. Do we have time for questions and reactions? Or you, and for how long do I speak?
Well, technically, we're supposed to stop at 3, but...
I'll stop before then. If I stop at a point and then to 6.
Yes. But we probably can carry on a bit longer.
I have a formal text in front of you because my memory is bad, and forgive me for reading, but I hope I won't have my head down all the time. So to begin, one of the greatest accomplishments of ancient Israel, I would say, is that it bequeathed Yahwistic monolatry to civilization, to human civilizations. And Western civilization in particular would not have flourished in terms of its art and music and architecture the way it did had it not been for monolatrous Yahwism. This form of monolatry, the worship of one God and only one God, emerged very late in the story of Israel, roughly 2,600 years ago. And it may surprise many people to discover that the concept of God has a very, very brief history in terms of the larger history of our species. This form of monolatry was essentially fashioned by Judeans who had been exiled to Babylonia by their conquerors roughly 2,600 years ago. And from them, it passed into Rabbinic Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Now, I see what you think of this statistics. Most human beings now living are monolatrous theists. They have bygone worshippers of the Semitic deity Yahweh to thank for the fulcrum and fundament of their lives. I know that some people don't like pronouncing any divine names, but originally with this name there was an iconic prohibition, no images, and much later on people wisely became sensitive to pronouncing any divine name, but I'm going to do so just for descriptive purposes today. Now my task and privilege in your midst today is to try and talk about God in what Rowan Williams describes theology as the least stupid way possible. That's theology. Trying to talk about God and divinities in the least stupid way possible, because that's an impossible task to do sensibly. More precisely, my brief is to address the history of the concept of God, or try to. And the principal aim of my little talk this afternoon is simply to illustrate that the word God, and this is not uncontroversial, the word God, like everything else pertaining to humankind, is entirely a product of history. It arose and evolved among people in very diverse historical settings over a long period of time, but compared with the age of Homo sapiens and the estimated age of both our planet and our universe, the word God is in a very early neonatal stage. Who knows how it will develop in future centuries? It gestated at an extraordinary late stage of human history, mostly during the late Bronze Age, that is, from 1550 to 1200 BCE. But it had antecedents at least 1,000 years before that. And since then, it has accrued a fascinating set of connotations and denotations. So now this word God. God is a simple-sounding monosyllable. As such, it enters the company of a host of other monosyllables in English that are easy to pronounce, yet very difficult to define. Consider, for instance, the following terms, each with religious overtones: joy, hope, grace, love, faith, hell, sin. As I say, these terms can be vocalized in an instant. It takes much longer to articulate what they might mean. While difficult to comprehend, they can at least be sketched to some extent, even if only in very vague terms. But the same cannot be said for the word God. While it can be uttered in an instant, it is utterly intractable to definition. It defies understanding. It causes bafflement of the mind. It can no more be grasped by the human intellect than can the features of the far distant future, which doesn't exist, so we can't possibly know how to think about it. None of us knows God, or has ever seen God, or experienced God, and the next advent is crucial, experienced God directly. God is spatially, experientially, temporally, epistemologically, and ontologically transcendent to humanity and human history. And I'm sure you're wondering at this stage, how do I know? Well, I'm only speaking in everything I'm talking about from the vantage point of my human perception. I could not limit that of which God might be capable, assuming there is a God, or gods. Yet I deploy the monosyllable God to refer to a deity that is not a thing, a person, a being, which can be encountered directly in the universe. God is ineffable and holy. I've always wanted to set an undergraduate exam question. What is the difference between divine holiness and divine glory? Very difficult terms. One refers to divine transcendence and the other to immanence, but we may get on to that. Holiness is one of the most difficult terms to decode in relation to God and within the world's religions. Now, all of this has been well appreciated in the past, which is why God has so frequently referred to as a Deus absconditus in the Latin tradition, a God who flees from all human attempts to depict God, or a Deus fugitivus, a fugitive God, who always escapes the pretentious clutches of human ambitions to describe realities and divine realities accurately. Am I speaking too quickly? Everything I have thus said has not stopped anyone, including me, from giving endless talks about God, endless tutorials about God, or from writing endless books about God, or from preaching or teaching about God. This simple-sounding monosyllable God is spoken at some stage by every single inhabitant of the English-speaking world, and it has direct equivalents in many other languages. Consider these daily instances of usage that our contemporaries frequently pepper their conversations with phrases such as "God save the Queen," "God bless America," "God help you," "God damn you," Praise be God. Thank God. God help us. God save us. God bless us. You're a God-awful person, sometimes said on the North American continent. Oh, God. God only knows. What a God-fearing person. God forgive us. God willing. Thank God. For God's sake. God only knows. Oh, my God. And God know. We could go on and on and on. Despite this daily God chatter, when people are pressed to account for what they mean by God, when they say God, they cannot always be able to give a coherent and credible account of whom or what the word God might designate. Alistair Campbell, when advising the then Prime Minister, Tony Blair, used to say, "We don't do God." Sunday morning television program was devoted to discussing religion in this country, often called the God slot. Talk about God is socially omnipresent. Faith in God is not. Now, my method. What if all I have been saying is the case? How can we decipher accurately the possible meanings of the term God? Firstly, one way is to examine the history of this term. It may have accrued different connotations in quite diverse cultures. Another way is simply to make an inventory, take stock of all the known deities that we have records that have been worshipped and venerated in the past. And a third way could be simply to consider the etymology of the word God in different languages. I'm going to mix all three methods to see what I end up with, if that's possible. And I'm going to begin by presenting you with what I'm calling the God Plateau. I'm going to liken the concept of God to a plateau of rocks. And our architectonic question this afternoon is simply this: whence this noun God? When did it emerge? How did it emerge? Why did it emerge? And I shall attempt to trace the history of this term by way of analogy with geological rock strata forming a plateau. And a plateau, I'm told by geologists, is an area of fairly high ground that is roughly level. And our imaginary plateau is level and high because it has been built up over the ages from deposited sediments that have turned into beds of rock. And just as plateau made of layers of rock can grow higher and higher over very long periods of time as sediment settles upon previously ossified beds of deposit, so too the term God encompasses layers of meaning that have settled upon each other as human history has unfolded in distinct cultures and civilizations. These layers are intertwined or tessellated like tiles on a roof, tessellated to such an extent that the little word God carries a crushing burden of meanings. Which is why I infuriate my students who say to me sometimes at the end of a tutorial, "Well, do you believe in God, yes or no?" And I said, "Well, I can't answer that question." And they say, "Why not? You're evading the question." I said, "Well, I have no idea what you mean by the word God, and I have no idea what you mean by the verb to believe. Do you mean I give my heart to, I'm looking for, I can prove mathematically?" I think I'm avoiding their questions. A crushing burden of meanings. Now, in Old English, the word God is one of the most used and in Old English and its equivalent. The word God is polyvalent and protean in many languages. In Old English, the term denoted a worshipped superhuman being or a deity. And this term is also found in Old Frisian, Old Saxon, Old Norse, Old High German and Old Dutch. The Latin word for God is Deus, which descends into French as Dies, and is related to, sorry, Dieu, French is Dieu, and the Latin word Deus is related to dies, a day. So light marks a day. So in this Latin tradition, or a Latin-French linguistic schema, God is light, the source of life. There would be no life on this planet without light. So that's one meaning of our word God. But then the monosyllable God can operate either as a proper noun, that is, as a name, or as a common noun, referring generically, to the category of deities, such as Baal is a god and El is a god. They're both gods. Let us now imagine ourselves excavating the god plateau of which I'm speaking. And to stop my monologue, I've got a handout to give you. And this is a 5-page handout. The first is just tabulating a variety of different kind of isms. I'll wait until you all have a copy. I've got plenty. Good enough. Everyone have one? Everyone got a copy? Hope this makes sense. And the first is a grid concerning beliefs. I regard any ism words like Protestantism or Catholicism or theism as a belief system. And here I've been working through different forms of belief. Many of these are not very common, but many are still common, such as autotheism, the belief that oneself is divine, not unknown. But I'll be using some of these words as I go ahead, especially polytheism, henotheism, and zootheism. Then over the page, I'm going to begin to excavate the God plateau, if that makes sense. I was going to call this the God rope with intertwining threads, but then I thought, how am I going to differentiate chronological periods with a rope? So I set upon strata, and at the end, right at the end on page 5, you have a legend to read the plateau. 12 different strata, and I'm sure you could think of other layers to add. I've been very, very selective. Does that make sense? So excavating the God plateau. Let's now imagine ourselves...
It's time that way.
Yeah, time is left to right, I beg your pardon, roughly 5,000 years ago, which is the beginning of recorded history, the Phoenix Black. I haven't got to the stage of perfecting it yet. So we're digging into this God plateau to see how many layers of sedimented meaning we can unearth. And as I said, I'm very keen to hear from other traditions whether any of this has resonance with what you know about any other religious tradition. This plateau has not stopped growing. A plethora of new understandings of God emerged in modern and what some people call postmodern material. All of these layers of meaning settled and formed at an exceptionally late stage of human evolution. As I hope to illustrate, monotheism, the belief that there is only one God, did not evolve, as far as I can see, in any notable way before the Middle Bronze Age, that is 2000 to 1550 BCE. But we know that Akhenaten, who died around 1334 BCE, a pharaoh of the 18th Egyptian dynasty, caused great consternation in his lands about 3,500 years ago by worshipping the Aten, a disc representing the sun in Egyptian mythology. This may be the first known instance of a veering towards monotheism. I don't know whether you would know better than this, but it's one of the earliest that I've been able to discover. But he nearly wrecked the Egyptian economy, which is meant to have a pantheon of several different temples. So once the pharaoh died, they went back to pantheon. There is, by the way, a contemporary opera by Philip Glass called Akhenaten, a beautiful opera about this pharaoh. Anyway, he was expected to worship a pantheon of deities. And its evolution, the evolution of his understanding of Sundis, was preceded during the Paleolithic Age, that is 100,000 to 30,000 years ago, not by belief in deities or our God, but by belief in animal spirits, totemic animal spirits. That's in the Paleolithic period, so archaeologists tell us. And from there, a little later in the Neolithic Age, around 8,000 to 3,000 BCE, this animal totemic spirit veneration seems to emerge into polytheisms, where we have cities being built and city-state deities being worshipped. So here then, in the Neolithic Age, we have the idea of polytheism, or rather the practice of polytheism emerging, as well as types of henotheism, less well-known, the appearance of one god as paramount amongst several gods. It may well be that the ancient Israelites had to purge their cult of both polytheism and henotheism by the time they reached their Babylonian exile. The concept of God as a creator that is common to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam is no older than roughly 4,000 years old. And the creation stories in the Bible, the very first chapter of the Bible, they were redacted during the Babylonian captivity. Before the advent of monotheism, language about gods, in the form of zootheism, which I'll come to, polytheism, and henotheism was evident in several late Neolithic cultures. That's around the latest 3,000 BCE, 5,000 years ago. And we know that this form of zootheism was present at Kengir, an ancient civilization in southern Iraq, which by its conquerors later became called Sumer, a Sumerian civilization. The study of ancient texts soon reveals that language about divinity is not a Christian or monotheistic invention. I'm sure you all know that. Stone tablets discovered since 1929 at Ras Shamra on the Syrian coast date from the second half of the second millennium BCE and reveal a colourful pantheon of 200 deities, the literature for which is older than the literature in the Bible. And these are in the city of, I'm not sure whether it's Ugarit or Ugarit. I'm going to say Ugarit. The Ugaritic text, they speak of the god El, an elderly patriarch. They speak of Asherah, a mother goddess, rather bloodthirsty. There are documents saying she used to love to wade knee-deep in the gore of people she'd killed. She was the consort of El, Baal, a young warrior, and Anat, the consort of Baal. And I'm relying here on my data on a North American scholar called Mark Smith, who began his career at Yale, then moved to New York the last time I heard of him, and I'm not sure where he is now, but he wrote a book in 1990 called The Early History of God, Yahweh and the Other Deities in Ancient Israel. Pharaonic Egypt could also boast a very large pantheon of deities such as Amut, Aten, Geb, Isis, Osiris, Seth, and Tefnut. All this is late, extremely late in human history. And I'll explain what I mean by late in human history. I mean by history only recorded human history. No sources, no history. That's the division for me between prehistory and history. Just how late this development of God talk can be illustrated as follows. Since Homo sapiens is a species that has survived for at least 100,000 years, and because the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, the story of a documented chatter about God is breathtakingly recent, and I'm intrigued why. Moreover, Today there are many people, religious and otherwise, who are disinterested in God and talking about God. And in other religious traditions, such as in Theravada Buddhism, I think, for instance, it's not focused on a personalized concept of God. And we happen to be living in a time and place, and I'm taking what I say next from sociologists in Great Britain, we are living in a time and place characterized by widespread irreligion and hedonism. In short, God talk is not an ever-present phenomenon in human history, ancient or recent. Even the major religions of the world today only emerge in the very late stages of human evolution. Over the past 3,000 or 4,000 years, and not all of them are theistic by any means. So the question of why people began to talk about God so latterly and why they continue to do so becomes all the more intriguing. Our friend at New College, the contemporary zoologist Richard Dawkins, memorably illustrates just how recently human beings emerged during the vast extended historical process of biological evolution. He makes his point in his book Unweaving the Rainbow by engaging the analogy of outstretched arms like this, from left to right. And I quote from Dawkins, "Fling your arms wide in an expansive gesture to span all the evolution, all of evolution from its origins at the left fingertip to today at your right fingertip. This is all of evolution, all the way across your midline to well past your right shoulder. Life consists of nothing but bacteria. Many-celled invertebrate life flowers somewhere around your right elbow. The dinosaurs originate in the middle of your right palm and go extinct around the last finger joint of your right palm. The whole story of Homo sapiens and our predecessor Homo erectus is contained in the thickness of one nail clipping. As for recorded history, as for the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Jewish patriarchs, the dynasties of pharaohs, the legions of Rome, the Christian fathers, the laws of the Medes and Persians, which never change, as for Troy and the Greeks, Helen and Achilles and Agamemnon, dead, as for Napoleon and Hitler, the Beatles and Bill Clinton, they and everyone that knew them are blown away in the dust for one light stroke of a fingernail, one light stroke of a finger file, nail file." Unquote. Pardon me. There we go. Keep going. Clearly, then, the enterprise of theology, disciplined God talk, was unknown for by far the greater part of the existence of Homo sapiens. Excuse me. Before the invention of writing, obviously there were no documented theologies as such, but archaeological evidence of the hominid species Homo neanderthalis reveal that animal remains and plants were sometimes placed in their graves. We know this from Richard Southwood, a former Vice Chancellor of Oxford biologist, who wrote a wonderful book called The Story of Life in 2003. A wonderful book, but not very well known. At least among theologians, I shouldn't say it's not very well known. The fact that they put these objects in their graves may be an indication that the Neanderthals entertained religious beliefs. But even by the time the species became extinct around 27,000 years ago, theologies had still not been written. As for the word theology, bandied about so much in our faculty here in Oxford, this university, obviously it comes from Greek philosophy. Plato deploys the original term in his dialogue, The Republic. And in the course of a conversation in this work, Socrates and Adeimantus, Plato's brother, agree that founders of communities need to give guidelines to poets about the appropriate way to talk about the attributes of the gods. And at one point, Adeimantus asks, what are these guidelines for talk about the gods? To which Socrates replies, whatever the type of poetry, epic, lyric, or tragedy, God must always be portrayed as he really is, says Socrates, unquote. And during the ensuing dialogue, Plato provides his understanding that God is good, perfect, and unchanging. And the term Plato deploys for talking about the gods in Greek, the theologias, the Greek equivalent of our word theologies. And he uses the term for God, opteos, which means literally the God. And Plato uses the capital theta, the eighth letter of the Greek alphabet, for both these words, theology and gods. Sumerian now, zootheism, and here's the first layer on page 2 of our plateau. I know I'm labouring the point, but it is easy to overlook that theology is a surprisingly recent invention. For most of the existence, humans did not write them. And there is an obvious reason for this. Writing was only devised roughly 5,000 years ago, towards the end of the Neolithic Age. It was invented, as far as I can see, in the land of the people of Kengir, which is now contemporary southern Iraq, a great cradle for civilizations. Excuse me. If history can be said to commence when sources document concepts and ideas, and data for subsequent generations to scrutinize, then we could say that prehistory ended in Sumer and history began in this region of southern Iraq. Writing, when it was first invented, was logographic. And a logograph is a sign or symbol that, when inscribed, for instance on a clay tablet, it represents a thing, a word, or a concept. By the year 3000 BC, there were six logographic systems in use around the Near East. From Mesopotamia, writing spread to Egypt and the fertile valleys of the Indus valleys. Logographic writing was later apparently independently invented again in China and Mesoamerica. And here I'm relying on the work of the American scholar David Leeming, who wrote a book called Jealous Gods and Chosen People, The Mythology of the Middle East. With the invention of logographic writing, the story of theology, God Chatter, was born. And the people of Sumer in the late Neolithic era venerated a father god called An, A-N. And he was envisaged as a great bull. And his female mate was Ki, and his son was called Enlil. So this veneration of An is therefore a form of zootheism, the belief in animal gods. First layer in our rock plateau. And on this plateau, it's only 5,000 years old, as I say, but it's typical of many other late Neolithic cultures. I'm just picking on the Sumerians for way of illustration. On this first layer, lay another stratum of Western Semitic conceptions of God, found in Ugarit and among the ancient Israelites. It is clearly different, the literature of these people. The Ugaritic literature is far more ancient, from roughly 1350 to 1150 BCE. It's more urban, cosmopolitan, and centralized. But in contrast, the ancient Israelites, their literature was more rural, was far more diverse topologically and territorially, says Mark Smith, and had a more extant literature going right up to the year 160 BCE. As for words denoting God, a variety of terms referring to figures regarded as divine coalesced amongst ancient Western Semites. And Ilu is the Akkadian word for God, I-L-U. The word used in Ugarit for God is Il. In Biblical Hebrew, it's Hel. Yet these words, I can show you how they're written down, I'm not a specialist on Semitic languages, I can show you. Yet these words can also refer to living and dead kings, as well as gods. In taking an inventory of ancient Semitic terms for a divine figure or god, one characteristic, and this is fascinating, one characteristic becomes fascinating. And here I'm relying on Mark Smith again to quote from his book, The Origins of Biblical Narrative. Apart from cult objects and places, divinity seems to betoken status or being significantly greater than that of human beings. In general, to be divine is not to be human, unquote. I'm fascinated this by a contemporary tendency amongst theologians to say when humans suffer, gods must suffer, gods suffer. But according to this ancient schema, the primary characteristic of a god is simply not human in any way and has a greater status than anything human. This seems to be common to many ancient traditions. So this is one thing we can cling on to. A god is not a human and is more powerful, in a sense, than a human. Ancient Israelites were not always strict monotheists. The cult of Yahweh eventually became dominant, but several passages in the Bible indicate that Israelites also recognized the gods of Canaan, or Canaan in Hebrew, Canaan, in their daily lives. During the period of the Judges, that is 1200 to 1000, and I quote Mark Smith, the major deities in the territory of Israel included Yahweh, El, Baal, and perhaps Asherah, unquote. El, Baal, and Asherah were all Ugaritic and Canaanite gods. And iconography and text attest that El was an aged, bearded, and enthroned patriarchal figure. And in the Bible, Yahweh too is portrayed as a patriarchal god. And we can see that in the book of Isaiah, chapter 40, Job, chapter 36, and the 102nd Psalm. Over time, El became identified with Yahweh among Israelites. The identification was settled by the 10th century, at least according to Mark Smith. Now, on this second bed, we move to a third bed on our plateau, and on this ossified sediment fell ancient Greek and Roman understandings of God. And attributes of God philosophically categorized by the Greeks and Romans, what many Westerners today mean by the word God. I say many, but not all. So this God is the possessor of super eminently admirable attributes. So God is eternal, whereas we are temporal. God is infinite or everlasting, whereas we are finite and mortal. God, strange to say, is simple, because God is indivisible. We are complex, because we can be cut up. God necessarily exists. It could not be that there were no God. God is omnipotent. We are spatially limited. God is omniscient, omnibenevolent, unoriginate or without origin, infinite, immutable, impassible, unembodied, metatemporal, and metahistorical or transcendent. Are you coping thus far? We haven't got long to go, and I'll stop for some reactions. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the attributes of God according to which God is completely powerful and unchanging stem principally, as we all know, from ancient Greek philosophy in the 5th century BCE. But earlier characteristics of God, characterizations of the gods represented in the works of Homer and Hesiod, portray the gods as badly behaved human beings writ large. According to these traditions, the gods are mischievous, malevolent, playful, and sexually rapacious. However, from the 6th to the 5th centuries, Greek thinkers began to describe the gods in less anthropomorphic and more abstract ways. Hence the more philosophically advanced tradition of depicting God as perfect, unchanging, and all-powerful. The Roman politician Cicero transmitted developed Greek understandings of deities to a Roman audience with his treatise De Natura Deorum, The Nature of the Gods, which was composed around 45 to 44 BC, getting closer to the time of Jesus now. Greek philosophical concepts of God, whether anthropomorphic or abstract, represent just one thread in the God rope, or rather the God plateau. And another plateau comes from the Hebrew Bible, a second one, that God is proclaimed as a fatherly creator who intervenes in history, will kill the enemies of the Israelites, will punish the wicked, and will comfort the downtrodden. Now, that is sediment four. There is no escaping the situation, and many don't like this kind of talk, that this one and only God, which has been formulated around 2,600 years ago, once henotheism had been purged and polytheism had been purged, this God could be very violent and punitive, as many deities were or are. And here is an illustration from the prophet Hosea. We have God talking. Yet I have been the Lord your God ever since the land of Egypt. You know no God but me, and besides me there is no saviour. Interesting for the world religions. There is no saviour besides me. It was I who fed you in the wilderness, in the land of drought. When I fed them there, they were satisfied. They were satisfied, and their heart was proud. Therefore they forgot me. So I will become like a lion to them, like a leopard I will lurk beside the way. I will fall upon them like a bear robbed of her cubs, and will tear open the covering of their heart. There I will devour them like a lion, and as a wild animal would mangle them. Well, enough to give us nightmares. Well, isn't it? Here's another story. This is from the second book of Kings, chapter 2, about the prophet Elisha asking God's help to deal with a pack of naughty little boys who had been teasing the prophet. And he went up from there to Bethel, and while he was going on the way, some small boys came out of the city and jeered at him, saying, "Go away, bald head, go away, bald head." When he turned round and saw them, he cursed them in the name of the Lord. Then two she-bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the boys. Another horror story. But boys, violence in association with deities is very, very common. And it's even common in universities and academic rhetoric. Notice how the way we talk. I will demolish your argument. I'll shoot you down in flames. I can easily attack your position. It's all rhetorical violence. And it's... we've become too sensitive, too desensitive about it, I think. After this prophet Elisha, about 2,000 years ago, a long Christian tradition about God became the fifth layer of sediment in our God plateau. And here, a Semite called Jesus began to be identified with the Creator God. And it took some centuries to do so, but the final point of this declaration came in 325 at the Council of Nicaea, when Jesus was said to be of the same substance as God the Creator. And moreover, in the 4th century is the crucial period when early Christians began to formulate a concept of a triune God. God is Father, Son, and Spirit. The Trinity is not a biblical doctrine, and you may want to discuss that. Sixthly, here's a wonderful way of God talk. On this level, the Christian level, and within this tradition, and Jewish tradition, and Islamic tradition, I'd love to know about Hebrew traditions, developed apophatism, the tradition that God can only say what God is not. with strange abstract categories like God is a dark light. The Flemish mystic Rusbroek says that. See what you think of this. All great theologians, whether they be Christian or otherwise, are or have been apophatic thinkers, the greatest of the theologians. They are acutely aware God is not human in any way, and we can only talk about what we can experience as humans. The great theologians of the Middle Ages, like Aquinas in the Christian tradition, Moses, Maimonides in the Jewish tradition, were apophatic in their language about God. But a further layer in the concept of God was laid in the later Middle Ages by the Islamic thinker Avicenna, who is followed by Aquinas. Now, I've got three more handouts here, one from Aquinas, which I'm going to talk about, and two by Gregory of Nyssa, who are apophatic theologians. Just wait until you all have copies. Let's settle up on that. Well, this is nice big print because I was using it in an overhead projection once. Now, I struggle to get this concept of Aquinas over to my students. It's one of the most liberating concepts that can be. We've got three pages, one of Aquinas, two of Gregory of Nyssa. The one of Aquinas is called Quies, the one who is. The still circulating. Then we have two quotations from the commentary of the Song of Songs by Gregory of Nyssa. That's the upper.
Surviving.
Okay.
Two of Gregory.
Have you got the one of Gregory which begins, "Whatever name we may adopt"?
Yeah.
This is one of the most beautiful quotations I know of to remind us of how difficult it is to talk of deities. And I'll quote. All got a copy? Whatever name we may adopt to signify the perfume of divinity, it is not the perfume itself which we signify by our expressions. Rather, we reveal just the slightest trace of the divine odour by means of our theological terms. As in the case of jars from which perfume has been poured out, the perfume's own nature is not known. But from the slightest traces left from the vapours in the jar, we get some idea about the perfume that has been emptied out. Hence we learn that the perfume of divinity, whatever it is in its essence, transcends every name and thought. Beautiful, an empty bottle, there is nothing there.
Ibn Arabi uses this kind.
Who does?
Ibn Arabi.
Oh, but I'd love to get a reference, if I may, Peggy, because that's just the kind of thing I'm looking for. And the second quotation is just the same lines. Then I'm on my seventh plateau. Avicenna, Islamic thinker, inspired Aquinas to say, and this is where I struggle with undergraduates to get me to agree with this, we can never say that God exists. That's oddly. Think of the philosophers of religion who argue all the time whether or not God exists. And what I mean by this, Avicenna followed by Aquinas say that essence and existence can be distinguished in things. The essence of a unicorn is to be a horse-like animal with a horn on its forehead. Whether it exists is another matter, but we can at least make that distinction. But according to these two thinkers, the distinction between essence and existence does not obtain in God, because God's essence is existence. God simply is, the sheer act of being. So this means we can never say God is a being, a thing, or a person that can be located. And the quotation from God, from Aquinas, is saying this. We can only say that God is, and nothing more. So is there a God or not? That's the correct question for Richard Dawkins and other people. Not, does God exist? Being a bit testy, aren't I? Moving on to the eighth layer, the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century. Reformation, because there are several, one in Geneva, one in Germany, one in Scotland, one in England. Concepts of God developed according to which God is remote. I'm generalizing massively, but I think there's a point here. God is remote and utterly transcendent. So transcendent that God cannot be manipulated by sacramental rites or for payments for indulgence to get people out of purgatory but so they could go to paradise. And notice I'm saying here that this God concept is remote and transcendent, and this differs markedly from the medieval layer where amongst serfs in feudal countries God is imagined as much closer to the people, watching them. They have to be careful because God will keep a tally of what they do wrong. And in feudal societies, people were far more egalitarian than they are now. I'm talking about amongst the peasants. They all shared the same lives all throughout Europe. They had the same problems, the same scarce amount of food. So they shared far more often, and their God was closely involved in their lives. Now, once we have the end of feudalism and the beginnings of the early stage of capitalism, and why is God transcendent? If God is pushed away, so utterly other that God is not watching me, I can exploit other people as much as I like. And so making money only works with callous indifference to the suffering of the poor. So it's a difficult concept to grasp. I'm trying to tease this out. Massive generalizations. What strata am I up to now? Number nine. Aha. Descartes, Immanuel Kant. This is what I'm calling a modern subjectivistic stratum. God is that which can be postulated by me with my practical reason, Immanuel Kant, or intuited in my feelings, Friedrich Schleiermacher, or God is a projection of my subconscious, Feuerbach. Feuerbach doesn't work, by the way, with apophatic theology. He doesn't think of concepts of God that are not anthropomorphic, like dark light. Then, importantly, in the 20th century, layer 10, feminist concepts of God, such as God as mother, friend, and lover. And the key thing about feminism is to realize that language works. And if male gendered pronouns are used exclusively, especially with children and especially with young girls, if male gendered pronouns are used exclusively, the language to refer to God, the language will work to connote and denote that God is male. So that's the profoundest point of feminism. The second one is, if you say we must cling to male gendered pronouns, that unwittingly is a form of idolatry, because it's absolutizing a particular thing, such as a form of language and gender. Getting near the end, process thought and modern postmodern thought conceives of God as dynamically evolving, as a serendipitous creativity, and an aesthetic ideal. Finally, see if we can work out which is my favourite concept of God, favourite stratum. Layer 12, 20th century and contemporary liberation theologies and concepts of God. God is not the possessor of admirable attributes like omnipotence and omnibenevolence. God is one who, by preference, loves the poor and the destitute. Why? Because if God is a creator, they are most desperately in need. And I'm going to give you now my final handout, which is a wonderful image about the contemporary distribution of wealth in the world. And liberation theologians are asking, does this human predicament matter? And consider the religious traditions you are interested in. This is from Bob Sutcliffe. Imagines the world as a big city with skyscrapers. And to the right-hand side, on the upper hand, is where most wealth is now situated. And the flat plateau is where there are least resources amongst human beings, where most of them are. Now, liberation theologians are simply asking, does this matter? Does this matter for religions and God? And they say, yes, we should stop thinking of God as the guarantor of the admirably powerful and think of God as the one who loves the downtrodden. You know that story. To conclude, with 3 minutes left, I am left wondering, after everything I've said, and thank you for your patience, I am left wondering what the next stratum of meaning in the God plateau will be. And could it transpire that Christianity may well learn something about God and gods from Hinduism? That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Philip. Yes, thank you for that very rich survey. I think we'll carry on to 15:15. If anyone has to go, then you'll quite understand, but we'll carry on to 15:15. Responses, questions?
We started off with a lot of breadth, a whole range of what we can know. I don't know how far we've talked with any anthropologists about what we might know about indigenous traditions contemporaneously. I would have thought that might be interesting for you. But you've started off with the breadth and then really come into the Christian stream with which you sort That's of ended. Right. Because, there's an interesting question about whether that matters to you, all of that, because, and I know where your heart lies, because of a certain view that derives from a doctrine of the incarnation sort of person Jesus was, or whether your theology has come from your ones, I'm not there targeting you at all, ones, sort of middle-class social concerns as a Westerner with those concerns. You know, which way round is it coming? Which, of course, is one of those $32,000 questions about our theologies. Is it because of the sort of people that many Christians are that they want to say God is like this? Or is their activism deriving from a Christian theology built on Jesus of Nazareth, in which case, why didn't it happen before, of course? Why, for all those many thousands of Christian years, has that not really, except perhaps among the friars?
This interests me.
That's a very big question in it all, isn't it?
It is indeed, and to your first point, I'm in the very infancy of thinking about these things. I'm just beginning really with a very limited Western European concept of God. And now, one of the reasons I'm here today is to make context, to begin to see how this might be considered in other traditions, but by anthropologists as well. You'll notice I mentioned Jesus very, very little. And this liberation theology isn't related to him. I would never call Jesus a liberation theologian or... But what I'm worried about, before, all religious traditions have been concerned with the needy and the poor and looking after them. There's been great carrot of care throughout human history. What is new and has never been seen before is the population of the human species has never been so big, over 6 billion at one time. And never before has most human beings been malnourished and poor. So it's really the striking difference numerically between the number and extent of poverty and a small group of super abundantly wealthy people. That's what is really motivating me, Peggy.
And this is 2001, and the picture's changing all the time.
Exactly.
They've just suspended aid to India, the government of the United
Kingdom. I haven't heard that.
They've frozen that one with some. They've actually withdrawn aid, like I think to China. Yes. But with India, they've, for the moment, I think, kind of frozen it because it's in such a moving situation. And one could ask about those disparities within one culture.
That's reflected in the other way, isn't it, I think? From right to left.
No, you're absolutely right. So I'm very much in the infancy of this project.
Yeah. But in the kind of world in which we live, things are changing so quickly.
Yes.
That the issues, in a way, in relationship to the religious change.
Thank you, Peggy. So anthropology.
I think you might enjoy talking to anthropologists about indigenous people's views.
In your plateau, from number one right the way through, do you think there's progress in that development? Is there an implicit progress, would you say?
That's a good question. I think there's real progress with prophets in any tradition. So I regard that as, I regard the apophatic tradition as real progress, because that's making the most clear distinction between that which is human and that which is not, from which is what I learned most from the ancient Western Semitic traditions, as the fundamental common attribute of the gods, they're not human.
And that's where Buddhism stands in a way. You could call Buddhism an apophatic tradition. That you don't have a description which is of a personal ultimate reality. But that's also there in the, who am I to say, in Advaita Vedanta Hindu,
well, people here know, that know is far this way of about talking? That.
I mean, you know, that you can't say, or even if you can, Satchit Ananda, the only.
And there are emails about
you know, but you know.
Well, I mean, I would say that even currently in Hinduism, you find a lot of these different plateaus.
Do you?
And so you find people who have the idea of the personal God, who's fully transcendent, but also. I guess the difference between avatar and incarnation, that the descent is there and is descending in the world but is not in human form in the sense of a physical form made of matter, but the form is still visible, so it's still in the world. Mm-hmm. So that idea is there, and then the idea of that the ultimate form of divine is impersonal and is sort of neutral to our needs in terms of this idea of the poor and destitute. There's certain laws like the law of karma, but there's no specific interest in humanity. And then you have like in certain traditions where, as you described, the gods are described as someone to be careful of and to stay away from. And there's many, you know. But even in those traditions, there's generally one prominent god. So, I mean, that's the only thing that comes to my mind.
Oh, thank you.
Do you think it's fair to say, as I certainly, I've been with people who have said that Hinduism, in that sense, is a cumulative tradition. That whereas, in a way, in Western thinking, I don't like that term at all. One might go from one thing and you leave something behind, and then, you know, go on to something which in some ways is a refinement. But there's a sense in which India, I remember the image that was once suggested to me, if you look at the forms of transport in a street in somewhere like Delhi, you've got the whole history of transport there in front of you, that nothing becomes rejected and old. And in a way, the philosophy and religion is like that. And, I mean, thought of in an entirely positive way, that it's cumulative. It's all still there. Yes. In some group or in some way or another, rather than this sense, well, when we move on to that, a scholar might go back to it, but somehow we've grown out of that, so we move on. Because some of these ideas, certainly people in the West would think that their systems have grown out of, wouldn't they?
Well, yes. Going back to Gavin's point, of all these strata, in some ways there's progress with each of them. And for example, the Protestant tradition that God is transcendent, the great strength of that was that it was acutely aware that we can't just talk about God from what I think and my experience, which is one of the vulnerabilities of a later liberal tradition. And when some 20th century is when we're back to underscoring the transcendence of God. So perhaps there's progress with them all. One thing I do say that people can be, they're absolutized in certain concepts too much. For example, the Trinity, long-standing tradition. If you look at the Blackwell companion to modern theology, the word God doesn't appear in the index. It's Trinity. So some people think you can only think and talk about God in Trinitarian ways, which of course it's Greek ontological language, and there's no reason why people have to be constrained to think that way. And Immanuel Kant said it wouldn't matter if there are 10 persons in the Trinity. But I think that you could have a case for saying God is one, or God is love, or God is creator. And Yahwistic monolatry, hesitant. I'm not in a position to know whether there are other gods or not, and on whether there is not a god. I prefer an agnostic stance, that we do not have the intellectual means to decide. I'm not trying to avoid the question, But I would say to atheists, you do not have the intellectual equipment to say yes or no definitively. All we can argue with is probably or improbably. Sir Richard Dawkins has now in his latest book said it's highly improbable there is a God. And Keith Ward said it's highly probable there is a God. So we're making some progress. So I'm wary of traditions that are a bit rigid and absolutize their own schema. I think there's progress and questions with all of these, really.
So have you talked to people who tell you that they know because they have experienced God? You seem to...
Well, yes, because this is the idea of with God there can be no unmediated immediacy. There's no immediacy. What people mean by experiencing God, they are encountering a reality in their experience which they are interpreting as a divine mediation. So this is the Scottish theologian John Bailey says, because mediated immediacy, any talk of immediacy with God is mediated through something, even if it's my body or my emotions or my brain. I can't have direct encounter with God, which is ancient in many traditions. And that's all I meant. But many people say, I have experienced God as if I've had afternoon tea with God, and I would question that.
You wouldn't know if it was God or an angel, would you?
No.
If it's something bigger than yourself.
Even philosophers arguing whether or not there is a God because of motion in the world. I said, well, even if you come to a prime mover, Aristotle had a prime mover. Who says that's the same as God? Well, there's only one prime mover.
Gnostics thought there wasn't, didn't they? The Gnostics thought the creation was different from the transcendent.
Exactly. Richard Swinburne, he would say, a venerable philosopher of religion in Oxford, God is a person. A person. That's what I can't see how you get that. Others say God suffers. Many would disagree with me, and I can hear them shouting now, that I didn't mention divine revelation. People say we know about God because of divine revelation. And I think that's problematical because it can involve one in a circular argument of assuming at the outset what has to be demonstrated in critical discussion. And who says there is divine revelation?
Well, they vary too.
Someone. It always is dependent on human judgment. We don't have tape recordings of divinities.
But we know that those things that are claimed to be revelation vary too. They contradict each other.
Yes.
You had a point there.
Sorry.
I was interested in your if I got it right, in the Western Semitic traditions, in the second layer, God is depicted as, or the gods are not human or not a human. And then you connected that with the apophatism. And it's sort of, I was thinking of the sort of Hindu equivalents of that. And you linked those to sort of the apophatism, that you talk negatively about God in a sense. You say what he's not, or what God is not, is the only sort of meaningful thing you can say about him. If you look at the Hindu traditions, you have a similar notion there. In the Upanishads or the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad has a famous statement of the absolute that it describes as neti in Sanskrit, which literally means not. So it's meaning it's not this and it's not that, and that's the only meaningful thing you can say about it, which then becomes a whole topic, sort of the focus of discussion in the theological traditions that grow out of the Upanishads, where some take it that it really means you cannot say anything about God or about the Absolute, because as soon as you say something about it, something positive, you ascribe qualities to it, and it has no attributes, and therefore you cannot talk in a positive sense about it, but you can only negate what it is not. And then you have another strand which says, no, when you say something negative, when you say this, it is not this and not that, what you're actually saying is something positive, meaning that it is God has attributes that are not like our attributes, in that the attributes of this world. So God has unlimited attributes, but they're not like the attributes in this world, and therefore scripture says that it is not this and not that, and that's how we can can think of it, it sort of negates our wrong conceptions of it. But then I was particularly interested in your linking this with the Western Semitic tradition's notion of God is not a human, because I would say in the Hindu traditions that doesn't, the two don't really go together. In the sense that if you look at the Upanishads, where you have this phrase that, you know, neti neti, it is not this and not that, you also have the notion that there's the absolute, which in theistic traditions would be sort of labeled God, and which is Brahman, and then you have the Atma, which is the core of our being, of a human person, and those two are related. There's some relation between those, either in the sense that they're identical, or that they're sort of where you have different images that are used, that they're reflected. One is a reflection of the other, and so on. But in a sense that the Hindu traditions have more of a sense of thinking that God is different from anything in this world, but yet he's not different fundamentally from who we are, beyond our sort of humanness, in a sense, as the very core of our existence. So I thought that was an interesting sort of both a parallel and a difference between.
I've taken ample notes while we talk. I come back to you on that.
And similar in the Taoist tradition, the quintessential quote, it starts with the Tao that can be named is not the real Tao, the Tao that can be seen is not the real Tao. Oh. And but within that, there is a poetry that hints, that yet hints at something which I think can only be intuitively grasped and never rationally. And also that God, I can't remember it now, that's Shen, spirit is part of nature and a part of nature. Very similar to that.
Thank you. This is exactly the kind of thing that I'm looking for.
Yes, but I was just wondering this, you mentioned in the beginning this evolution of concept of God, and why is it this way that there are only few people who had, especially in Semitic religions, and also in Buddhism, that few people who had the revelation of God, and others followed. Why is it going this way, that only few people had the revelation or something transcend or philosophical?
Are you thinking in terms of Carl Jaspers' axial time? Do you know that theory?
No.
Are you asking why is it the origins of different religious traditions, not many people claim to have revelations? Well, Carl Jaspers has a theory of axial time. I think about 2,600 years ago, he says in different parts of the world, significant religious leaders and philosophical leaders all began to have an apprehension that human beings are not victims of fate, but they're in a mess, but they can do something actively to improve the situation of humanity, especially if they look beyond themselves to deities. So this is the sense of Gautama the Buddha, Confucius, Socrates, Plato, the prophets of Israel, Zoroaster in Persia. And of course, John Hick sets upon this. So there's a maturation in humanity around roughly the same period, and the great religious traditions are born. Well, Hinduism is before this, and they're coming from this idea that may be related to why there are just a few different thinkers or groups of thinkers spread around the world in the Indian subcontinent, in China, east of that, and in the Near East, what we call the Near East.
Some of the dates are very contested.
Well, I know it's a controversial thesis, but I'm just thinking.
Don't quite fit, actually, in terms of modern scholarship. But then you haven't got the great beginnings of Islam in that either. So,
no, I mean, it's much later, isn't it?
One of the most powerful of the revelatory claims, isn't it?
The most important thing I've learned with all of these traditions, which is common to them all, which I don't want to delay now, it's just a quick threefold categorical schema that I learned from a Harvard theologian, Gordon Kaufman. All language about deities all the time operates according to a threefold pattern. Every human being alive has an understanding of the world, cosmology. Every human being alive has an understanding of the human person, anthropology. And on the basis of what people know and experience about their world and their anthropology, they construct concepts about the absolute. And why are trendy liberal theologians in the Christian tradition fighting orthodox dogmatic theologians tooth and nail for ascendancy in the West? Because over time, all biblical, all pre-modern theology presupposes a Ptolemaic worldview and an Aristotelian anthropology, which have become defunct in the West, sorry Peggy, many cultures since modernity, and they haven't yet formulated a new language for that which they call absolute. But I say this happens in all religions. If you look at the way people are talking about deities in relation to the universe, they've all got a cosmology, they've all got an anthropology, and that's their basis for divinity talk. I must stop there.
I don't think Buddhism fits that model much.
I beg your pardon, Peggy?
I don't think Buddhism fits the model
much. Well, thank you, Peggy.
Doesn't fit a lot of the
model. I've got one more quick question, actually. I'm keeping everybody, but you mentioned at the beginning that the concept of God has fairly recent origins. I mean, considering the history of the world, as it were, and humanity as well.
In our documented sources.
It's come into fruition. And do you think it's going to die out? Do you think sort of future the concept of the category of God?
Well, that's a very good question. Well, I have to be consistent with my principles. Everything finite will die out or can die out. And so, if the concept of God is finite. It could die out, yes, for something else. Mm-hmm. Because where God or gods are deus absconditus, they just flee whenever they try and categorise them. So any way of talking must be perspectival if it's human. Mm. Leaving aside the question of whether or not there are gods or God.
Mm. Well, I think on that note, we'll come to an end. Thank you so much for this contribution to our speakers. Thank you for your feedback as well.